You've acted so much. You're that guy. You're a quote unquote that guy. You're one of these people who's in everything. You're in Billions, which I'm in. You're in. This is how much of a that guy you are. You're in Sopranos as two different characters in two different seasons.
not only that, both the best doctor in the city.
both are the best doctor in the city. That is the voice of Seth Barish. Seth Barish is my longtime collaborator, friend, actor, director. He directed all five of my solo shows, including The Old Man in the Pool, which is on stage on Broadway right now at Lincoln Center. It is running through January 15th. It must close, by the way. Must close. And tickets are going very quickly. I always tell people the least expensive way to get tickets, I say this to friends and family and everyone, is TodayTix, TodayTix.com. But Seth and I have worked together for a million years. He has an extraordinarily good book about acting that people swear by. I mentioned in the interview Pete Docter from Pixar. My college mentor, John Klavan, teaches it. It's called An Actor's Companion, Tools for the Working Actor. It's my favorite acting book. I mean, it's my favorite acting book. And he's the co-artistic director of the Barrow Group in New York City, which is a phenomenal, phenomenal theater company. Has great acting classes and productions. And we have a great conversation today. Enjoy my conversation with the great Seth Barish. This may be the loosest episode of Working It Out today because my guest is Seth Barish, who's directed all five of my solo shows, and we've just worked together for literally ever. It's funny, like, this is how you and I both always describe our collaboration. We always describe it as a 15-year phone conversation where, like, we never stop collaborating.
Yeah, that's right.
So for the listeners, I'll give like a super rough overview of your career, and you can sort of correct me where I'm getting it wrong. It's like you studied theater and acting and directing at UCLA in undergrad. Mm-hmm. It just so happened you dipped your toe in the comedy world because you were a pianist during college at the Comedy Store when you were underage, basically.
That's right.
And then you went on to be actor, director in countless things. I mean, you've acted so much. You're that guy. You're a quote-unquote that guy. You're one of these people who's in everything. You're in Billions, which I'm in. This is how much of a that guy you are. You're in Sopranos as two different characters in two different seasons.
not only that, both the best doctor in the city.
both are the best doctor in the city?
They're like, this guy's the best.
Oh my gosh. And then your theater company is called the Barrow Group, not to be mistaken with the Barrow Street Theater or the Barrow whatever. There's a lot of Barrow things. Yeah. Barrow Group Theater, which I've seen you act and direct. You put out some of the best theater I've ever seen in my entire life. The plays that you put on are spectacular. And so to give context to the listener, it's like you're someone who has worked as writer, director, actor, theater, film, television for, I would say 30 years, 30 something years.
35.
Yeah.
5 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then
more.
Yeah.
Close to 40. 40 years. Definitely 40.
And then what am I leaving out? Is there a big thing I'm leaving out?
Things.
Oh, you're a musician?
Yeah, I'm a musician.
You did a bunch. You do a lot of your own work and you scored a bunch of stuff in Don't Think Twice and Sleepwalk With Me. And you acted in Don't Think Twice as the sort of Lorne Michaels-esque character.
Yeah, that's right. I did that. I do recording and all that stuff. Also, in terms of comedy, prior to the Comedy Store, I actually was in a sketch comedy troupe. And I don't know if we've ever even talked about this.
But, in high school?
In high school.
Yeah.
Or just after high school. And then we had an improv component too. So our evenings were, two-thirds sketch, one-third improv and stuff.
Yeah.
And actually, that was one of the amazing things about when you, like, our origin story is, I feel like we should have, cue the music, is that And I don't know, I'm curious about your prior to us meeting a little bit, but my view of this was I showed up at work at the Barrow Group and by my office, I think I was meeting my wife, Lee Brock, who's the co-artistic director and brilliant. And you were outside the door. My memory is that you had a little backpack.
I had a gun, a knife, and some poison.
This got really dark.
We're going to cut this out. But yeah, we had a nice meeting.
It was great. A little scary, but
I had a script, a knife, and intentions. That's
what I said. Do you want to direct my play? And I looked at the knife and I went, yes. And then, no. What my memory of this is that you were just kind of, you just said, hi, my name is Mike Probiglia. I'm a comedian. I've been on Letterman.
Oh my God. And unbelievable. This is great.
I was like, oh.
This is really quality stuff. I'm cutting this immediately.
And then my recollection, she said something like, yeah, I'm writing a play, sort of, but it's like a mixture of stand-up and a play. And I was wondering if you'd be interested in directing it. And I remember saying something to the effect of, well, let's maybe show me some of your stuff sometime and I can come see it and everything. And then the next thing that I remember is the very next day, you sent me an email that I think maybe you had written on a plane or something like this.
And it said, your money or your life?
It said, the knife is real. Don't forget about it.
Don't disrespect me. And then it had a picture of a machine gun.
And there was a little blood in the corner.
Oh, my God.
I don't know what that was about. It probably was ketchup. But no, you said something to the effect of... It was a script, and it was a script from a portion of what was to become Sleepwalk With
Me.
But at that time, it was really just material about sleepwalking incidents and material about this relationship that had...
My breakup.
Yeah.
A really hard breakup.
I had. For sure. And but I did not know your voice at all.
Yes.
I didn't know what it was like hearing you talk. And I remember I looked at it and I was like, okay, it's something. I have no idea what to make of this. And then you sent me a CD of, is it called Dog Ears?
It was a self-released comedy CD, which no longer exists. It's an audio format from yesteryear. And it was called Dog Ears. And I'd self-recorded at the Washington, D.C. Improv in 2003, I want to say, 2002.
Yeah, instantly when I heard it, like a bunch of things clicked for me. Because the thing that struck me most, well, there were a couple things. One is like, oh, this guy's really funny. But the main thing was like, it just feels to me like this guy's this is just a guy talking. This does not feel performative to me at all, which completely lines up with everything I had been dedicating my life to. The whole origin of the Barrow Group as a theater company was I had seen a play when I was in college at UCLA, a student production, and about half the cast members in this student show were performing in this way where I could not tell at all that it was scripted.
Yeah.
Not even remotely. And I felt like, oh my God, I feel like I'm in the room with real people doing real things. And I had such an emotional response to the play. The play, which was, you know, probably flawed and stuff, but I just was like, I was so moved. And immediately I went, more of that. I just want to see more of that.
Yeah.
And then I ended up, you know, forming this theater company with like-minded people just all dedicated to that. And in comes you, who's like, wow, you're doing it in another form and you're doing the same thing. It's like, I cannot tell that you're performing. So immediately I went, I'm really interested in doing more with this guy.
Well, it's interesting that you should say that because the reason why it was a case of you and I were concurrently obsessed with a similar performance style.
Yeah.
And it just so happened that I was researching all the solo shows being performed around town because I'd written the script for Sleepwalk With Me. And I saw Martin Moran's The Tricky Part, which you directed. And similar to how you're describing when you saw a show in college that had this non-performance style, sort of what we sometimes describe as invisible design or an invisible direction. I just go, yeah, that. Like, I had seen a bunch of stuff. I had seen a lot of shows. And I was like, I need to meet that person. And what's funny about hearing you describe the young 23-year-old Mike Birbiglia, who is who has no sense of himself and his blind ambition.
Longer hair, I think.
Longer hair. And a little bit. And I had actually, this is how old this is. We're coming up, tomorrow is the 20-year anniversary of my debut on Letterman.
Oh, no kidding.
Tomorrow.
Wow.
20 years.
Happy anniversary.
Thanks. So I was drawn to your direction of Martin Moran's show, who Marty, by the way, came to The Old Man in the Pool the other night.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, when I saw that, I was like, well, this is the person who I want to work with. And this is the delusion of being a young artist. It's like, and of course he'll want to work with me too.
Well, I didn't not want to. No, it was one of those things. Something that really intrigues me about it because, you know, on occasion I'm approached by folks that also just a cold approach. And often I have like this spidey sense and I just go, oh, great, nice to meet you. And like inside I'm just thinking like, I don't think I want anything to do with this
right.
person.
I gotta get out of here.
And for some reason that did not trip off, that no alarm went off.
That's interesting.
It is pretty interesting to me.
Yeah.
Because to the extent where like Lee was like, are you going to do something with him? And I was like, well, he's just mad he came by, you know, because I was telling her about it.
So fast forward, this is our fifth show together. And what do you feel like is different from this first show, Sleepwalk With Me, and now The Old Man in the Pool, the fifth show, which is at Lincoln Center?
A lot. I feel like because of the fact that we've been having this ongoing, what we're calling a conversation, creative, you know, collaboration, I think we started to develop over the years a pretty deep group mind. I'm often struck by, you know, I'll have a thought at home, I'll either call you, but let's say you call me for some reason and you're starting to talk about something. And before you even say it, I'm like, I wonder if he's going to talk about this because it's on my mind.
Mm.
And you will, and then I'll go like, yep, we're totally talking about it.
Yeah.
And then often I'll say something and you go like, it's funny you should say that. I was just thinking about that. Like that's going on with us all the time.
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like, you know, you and I are friends with Liz Allen, who's a great improviser and improv teacher. And she taught me in college and did a workshop with me in college. And I feel like the principles of improv have served me in my artistic existence more than any single class or study
100%.
Or anything.
I was just thinking about this in depth last night. It's completely.
Yeah.
It's there's something about when you're yes-anding everything around you, where all of a sudden obstacles and bumps kind of go away.
Yeah.
You know, instead of coming against this thing and going, oh no, you're just like, well, that's the thing. So where are we going from there? And it shows up in so many ways.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary concept, this idea of yes-anding. I feel like, because I feel like yours and my relationship, it's a little bit of a chocolate peanut butter meets peanut butter kind of thing, which is a sense that like chocolate meets peanut butter, peanut butter Reese's peanut butter cups, you know, let me tell you about
peanut butter with
let
a
me
knife.
Tell you about candy. So there's Rolos, and Rolos are caramel, and there's chocolate around them, and then there's
good.
Twix, and that's nobody Not, really knows what's in that.
Yeah.
But what we're really talking about is Reese's peanut butter cups.
Yes, that's right.
but the chocolate peanut, the chocolate meets peanut butter of it all.
There's an accident and it goes together. Is that what you're getting?
Yeah, I would say it's that I have a very comedy obsessed existence, with a lot of interest and intrigue in theater. And I would say you have a very theater obsessed existence with an intrigue and interest in comedy.
Yeah, I'd say that's right.
And so I think as a result, we're able to sort of speak these two languages simultaneously.
Yeah.
Speak the language of theater, speak the language of comedy.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then we're able to sort of coalesce. We've able to make these hybrid shows together that sort of use both of those.
I'm kind of amazed at how often my time with the sketch group that I was together with high school with these two, you know, brilliant guys who were way funnier than I was. And I'm amazed at how often the fundamentals of what we were doing then are showing up in what I'm doing now.
Yeah.
Constantly. And same thing with the Comedy Store. Like, you know, when you're playing piano in an improv situation.
And this is in the late 70s, early 80s, where like Robin Williams was improvising.
Oh, yeah.
It was like a murderer's row of people.
It was ridiculous. I wish I could even remember all the names, but the Comedy Store Players, which was the name of the group that showed in the main room on Monday nights, and I didn't play with them. I played with another group. I can't remember their name. But it was
you played in an alley around the corner where it was next to a garbage pile.
The only thing I always tell about that thing is like, because people, you know, like I mentioned that Rob, and well, just to close off what I was saying before, I played with this group that played before the Comedy Store Players went on, sometimes after.
Okay.
So I was always there and I could see them. And one night I got to actually play for them because their pianist got sick and all this. It was nice.
Yes.
But and Robin Williams notably was not there that night. And I remember just going, oh damn it.
Oh yeah.
The funny thing that I always think of with Robin Williams is literally every time I showed up at the club without fail, I worked there for probably like a year and a half. I would go to the backstage, knock on the door, you know. And they'd open the door, it would be Robin Williams, and he'd go, can I help you? Having no idea who I was. And I'd say, oh yeah, I'm the pianist for so-and-so. He goes, oh, great, come on in. Like that. Next week, can I help you? Yeah, I'm the pianist for so-and-so. Oh, great, come on in.
He never clocked it.
No.
Yeah.
But anyway, there was so much. It's so funny, we're talking about group mind. I actually just, right here, right now, thought of this thing with, when I played for the Comedy Store Players, there was some kind of bit going on and it turned into this kind of detective thing, and just I was sort of following. And you know, as they did something that was at all suspenseful, I played this like bum, ba-dum, bum, you know, on the piano and everything. And it became like a running gag in the sketch. And then at one point, they said something, and I didn't play it because I think I was just spacing out.
Yeah.
And like literally, the entire group that was involved in the game like turned to me, just looked at me and went bum, ba-dum, bum.
Oh my gosh,
that's
great.
All like completely choreographed. And I was like, wow. Not only did they have the impulse to do it, which of course I understand, they did the same move.
Yeah.
They did the same thing. It's like one of those things like, wow, these people are tuned in.
It's a crack squad.
Yeah, it was really good.
And you've taught like an extraordinary group of actors through the years at the Barrow Group, including Anne Hathaway, Tony Hale. Yeah. Like, I mean, the list goes on and on and on. Leslie Kritzer, who was here the other night.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sarita Chowdhury, Purna Jagannathan, Michael Stolte. There's a lot of people.
It's an extraordinary list. Yeah. And when you're teaching actors, what do you find is the easiest thing to fix?
Well, usually the easiest thing to fix anyway is that I always hate the word fix because it sounds
I know.
Finite.
What's the the easiest like quick hack on stuff? You know, I'm making it worse.
So what's the completely hacky, horrible thing you do?
What is the total failure of your students that you challenge and destroy?
Actually, I think I can answer that. I think that typically actors somewhere along the way, understandably, develop a sense of what they think acting is.
Mm-hmm.
And included in that are things like, well, I think I'm supposed to like have opinions about what the character is like. I think I'm supposed to decide what I'm doing at every moment. I think I'm supposed to decide maybe how the character is feeling and all this stuff. And to me, all of that is actually aside from the point.
Yeah.
That I suppose I think of acting as, you know, you read a script, you figure out what are underlying circumstances, which is simply things like, you know, who are you? I'm a waiter. Where are you? I'm in a restaurant. What time of day? What happened just before this?
Yeah.
Think these basics, right? And then you just kind of show up and talk and listen.
Yeah.
Occasionally there's transformational things asked of you. We have to do a dialect or, you know, makeup or something like that. But so the actors come in, they have these ideas and they start to kind of do their thing. You know, they execute their ideas and it feels like you're watching somebody executing an idea. And so typically what's happening is I'm spotting that, and Lee, who I teach with, is also so brilliant at this, will spot it and then we'll kind of apply techniques that will help them basically get distracted from their ideas and let them go, so that all of a sudden it's like, oh yeah, there's a person talking right here, right now.
Yeah, and you have a book on acting that is beloved by, you know, icons in in art. I mean, I mentioned Anne Hathaway, who blurbed the back of the book, but also Pete Docter, who is the who runs Pixar and directed Inside Out and Up and many classics.
Yeah, I went to heaven a zillion times once. I was walking with pizza friend, a mutual friend of ours, and I was walking with him, and he was asking me, he goes like, so, you know, and he was recording the soundtrack for one of his films, and he said, yeah, you know, I'm enjoying using your book. And I was like, what? And he goes, yeah. And he pulls out from his wallet this little, like, he had a laminated business card size thing with the, his favorite tips that were all just like, you know.
That's incredible.
I just was like, oh, my God, I just went to heaven.
No, my mentor, John Glavin, who taught me screenwriting, I believe begins every class with a passage from your book.
That's crazy.
Yeah,
that's just crazy. No,
your book has a ripple effect in the universe of acting. I think it's a real revered text.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's fascinating. I mean, you must relate to that. Like when you put something out in the world, and then you're done with it in a way. You're off to other things, and then people are like, "Going that thing you do."
And then people steal it, and a more attractive person performs it, and then they're very popular and famous,
and they're Paul Rudd.
And then they're Paul. It is an interesting thing when you put something into the world and.
For the record, Paul did not steal anything.
No. We're goofing around because of this review where someone said that if my show, the new one, becomes a movie, it must star Paul Rudd, not acknowledging that I'm an actor also, and that actually I could play the myself role too.
And they doubled down on the next show, and they called back to that thing like and said something about like we're having a Twitter war about this.
Yeah,
like, there's I don't no think war. There's any Twitter
yeah, yeah,
war.
Yeah, there's only one way war. Waged. Working It Out is brought to you in part by GameTime.co. That's not GameTime.com. I don't know. That's a whole other thing. GameTime.co. is a site where you can get the best tickets for events, sports events, concerts. This is a thing that I'm obsessed with. I don't know about you, but I'm very experience-based, especially if I'm bringing my family. I just want to make sure that the seats are good and I can see everything. And I just think this is a great site. It's an amazing interface, last-minute tickets, flash deals, zone deals, easy to find and buy tickets for every kind of event in your area. Views from all seats in the venue, lowest price guaranteed, event cancellation protection, job loss protection. Take the guesswork out of buying tickets with Game Time. Download the Game Time app, create an account, use the code WIO, that's for Working It Out. That's WIO for $20 off your first purchase. Terms apply. Again, create an account and redeem code WIO for $20 off. Download Game Time today. Last minute tickets, lowest price guaranteed. Working It Out is supported by MasterClass. We are thrilled to be supported by MasterClass. It's a streaming platform that makes it possible for anyone to watch or listen to hundreds of video lessons taught by more than 150 of the world's best. So, for example, Working It Out listeners might be interested in filmmakers or writers like David Sedaris, Issa Rae, Martin Scorsese, Werner Herzog, Malcolm Gladwell, and more. Margaret Atwood teaches creative writing. Amy Tan teaches fiction, memory, and imagination. That sounds fantastic. Whether you're watching MasterClass on TV, listening in audio mode, or in the app, or on their site, the quality speaks for itself. This holiday season, give one annual membership and get one free at masterclass.com/perbigs. Right now, you can get two memberships for the price of one at masterclass.com/perbigs. Masterclass.com/perbigs. Offer terms apply. Often, people will message me and say, you know, how do I start telling stories on stage, or how do I, you know, I feel like I only get 3 minutes to perform stand up at an open mic, blah, blah. And it's like, I totally sympathize with that because I was there. I lived that for sure. Yeah. And I would say, like, what would be your advice for those people who say, like, I only get 3 minutes, I only get 4 minutes. How do I become a storyteller with this brief amount of time?
I mean, I usually steer people towards, you know, thinking of one thing that happened to them that was meaningful that they want to communicate, they want to tell the world about. And it's the one thing becomes the anchor for the whole thing.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that I noticed with you, and I know you and I have taught together at Princeton and in another number of environments, actually. And I think one of the things that we run into often is that people get up and they're just telling stuff, you know, and they might be, maybe they're trying to be funny or they enjoy a particular image or something, and they just like go on and on. A lot of times they talk about how they feel, you know, like, I was so sad about it.
Right. Okay. A lot of adjectives.
Lots of
adjectives and adverbs.
Yes.
Yes.
I was hugely, hugely sad. And I was like, okay.
I went to this party. It was so crazy. I went skiing on this
really
on this mountain.
Crazy?
It was so big, you know. Which, no offense to those people who tell stories, like at a party, that is a certainly good anecdote to tell and connect with people on.
Yeah, yeah.
When you're on stage in front of strangers who couldn't give less of a fuck about you, people want a story that has some meat to it and some stakes.
Yeah, and the idea is that if it really means something to you, then the odds go up it's going to mean something to somebody else. And so if for somebody who's looking for the 3 minute, you know, slot version of that, say, just think of the thing. And just tell what happened. I think it's a natural thing. I think in life, as we are just kind of socializing or going to dinners or whatever, we end up telling stories. And not only that, we cycle back. There's some ones that are the go-to things. Like that Robin Williams thing, I must have told that like 50 times in my life. It's a really interesting thing to me.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know why, but it's just kind of interesting. And so as you tell it, you're gaining practice on telling it, I suppose, and then you kind of sculpt it automatically, organically. It's not like you're even thinking about it. But then all of a sudden, people sit down to write a story for something official, and it's like all those organic processes just melt.
Right.
And they're like, they're overthinking it, and they it's got way too many words, and often what's happening when I'm working with folks, and I've seen you do this as well, you're just like, if I gave you like, you know, 30 seconds to tell me the thing, just what's that version?
Yes.
You know, and then all of a sudden, a lot of things improve usually for people.
There's another question that Mabel had is like, what do you feel like is the defining difference between what we do with solo plays and with ensemble plays that you've directed?
When you're working with a play that somebody has written in a normal way, with, you know, where they spend a lot of time writing by themselves, and then they maybe do a reading of it and all that stuff. By the time you're working on it, it's kind of mostly baked.
Yes.
In solo shows, my experience is not that way at all. You're coming, you have like either elements of a story, or fundamentally this one thing that happened. I think, in contrary to what we were just talking about, a lot of your pieces evolve in a slightly different way, in that you have elements of things that you're kind of throwing up there, and there's a common thread that you'll be aware of, or maybe I'm aware of it as I experience it, and then that becomes like a sort of vague organizing principle for the thing, and then somewhere in the process it becomes clear, like, oh, I can see where this is going.
Yeah.
Whereas I think in a play, when you get it, that's written, it's all done, so there's no dramaturgical part.
Mm-hmm.
Dramaturgy is refers to, you know, facilitating the writing of something, usually via questions.
Mm-hmm.
You're just asking artistic questions about it, and then it has an effect on the shaping of the piece. So it's pretty different with a solo show. There's a lot of shaping going on where there isn't in the.
Well, I'll give people an example of that if they don't understand what you mean by dramaturging. So like, for example, like when Seth and I were first working together and on Sleepwalk With Me, I said, you know, I had this breakup, and it was with my college sweetheart, and we fell in love and this way and blah, blah. And I told you a story from it, and you said, well, I'll echo back to you what I'm hearing.
Yeah,
what I hear from you is you fell in love with this person, and it got very serious, and then you felt like you needed to get out, and blah, blah. And then what I would hear back is, oh, but what about the part where in the middle of the night I woke up sweating or whatever? And you'd be like, yeah, you'd be like, I heard you say that, but I didn't take it in as the most meaningful part of it or the part that was my part of my takeaway.
Yeah.
And so sometimes what happens is I'm half making up an example. It's like, I'll go, oh, well, I have to really lean on that part so that the audience, in this case, the audience of one, of Seth Barish, understands that, no, that's what it's about for me. That's what this story's about for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the mistakes that I see people making when they're in the position of guiding people in their writing or directing or something like that is they think it's their job to give their opinion about what they're hearing.
It's good, it's bad, et cetera.
Get rid of that.
It's great, it's terrible.
And I don't think that's my job. I think my job is I may have opinions, but my job is to, well, to mirror back, this is what I'm getting. And that leaves the artist in the position to just as you articulated, they might kind of go, oh, I'm actually trying to get this other thing across. It's not getting across. Maybe I'll write to that and everything. And there's times, I wish I could think of some specific examples, but there's times when you've written something and my first thing when I hit it, I go like, internally, I'm like, that's never going to see the light of day. That is not going to exist in this piece. Yeah. But you'll stick with it a little bit. And I've grown to understand that if you or really or anybody is sticking with something, there's usually a reason for it.
Yeah.
And so the way I tend to view it is like, well, maybe anything will end up in the piece.
Yeah.
It'll be just interesting to see what form it takes. So a great example is, I mean, I don't want to give anything away about the show, but there's an extended improv thing that, you know, happened live.
In The Old Man in the Pool,
In The Old Man in the Pool. That is just insanely funny. And it was funny the very first time I ever saw you do it, which
Cherry Lane Theater, like on off hours.
Yeah.
I was doing like a workshop, working it out.
Just redoing it. And I remember thinking, that's so funny, but I can't imagine that would ever end up in anything. It's just so wild and crazy. And here it is. It's like the whole thing leads up to it.
Yeah. And you know, it's funny, like I was reminded by my friend Jean Korolitz the other day, who saw many iterations of the show, that when she saw early versions of the show, I think at City Winery a couple of years ago, there was a story that I tell about my dog dying.
Yeah, oh yeah, I remember that.
She said to me at the time, she goes, take that story out about the dog. She goes, take that story out about the dog.
Nobody wants to hear about a dead dog.
No, you know what she said? It was a really interesting note. She goes, this is a helpful dramaturgical note because it's actually not, it's not a judgment of the story itself.
Yeah.
She goes, there's nothing wrong with the story. It's an interesting story. It's about when I was a teenager and my dog died, got hit by a motorcycle. It was devastating. And she goes, I can't come back from it.
Oh, wow.
She goes, the next 10 minutes I'm thinking about the dog.
Oh, that's so interesting. That's so interesting.
And that is for the creatives listening, because there's a lot of creatives who listen, like, that's a helpful way to give a note, actually, is that, like, when you said XYZ thing, it my experience,
that's
not
right.
It's good, it's bad, it's boring, it's funny.
That's right.
My experience was I couldn't pay attention.
Yeah.
Because I'm just thinking about your dead dog.
That's right. And that leaves you in a position, it doesn't mean you're automatically getting rid of, I mean, of the dog as a It turned out
it was not in the show.
It
made its way out eventually.
It could have, you know, found its way there if it was a different thing. And the point being that you're hearing the effect it has on somebody, and then that puts you in the driver's seat of like, do I want to experiment with letting it go, or do I want to change what it is so that it has a different effect on people?
Absolutely.
But I think that,
or do I want to move it later in the show?
Yeah.
Because her feedback is she can't pay attention anymore.
Yeah.
But maybe that's in the final 10 seconds. Yeah, she's not going to need to.
That's right. Which is why I brought you here tonight. We're going to change the end. The end of the show now is like, by the way, I have a dog. Had a dog.
Exactly. Had a dog is a really short version of that story.
It's the subtitle.
I have a dog. I had a dog. Such like a Stephen Wright version of that one.
You were a huge fan of Stephen Wright, right?
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, me too. That's another place we overlap.
That's a common.
Yeah. The also I think there's a couple areas there. Like, we also, both you and I, are a huge fan of Richard Pryor's, like, vintage stuff.
Yes.
And there was something that we responded to about how just human it was.
Yeah.
And how it was like his shows were not all glitzed up. Like, a lot of times, whenever we're you know, shooting a special or something nowadays, they have all these camera moves and all this stuff. You used a term the other day that I loved, I'm going to remember forever, happy camera. It's like
camera happy.
Camera happy, yeah.
We were talking about directing the current show potentially long-term
And I was discussing a possible shot, and you're like, it's a little camera happy. And 100%, and then you look at these shows where Richard Pryor would just come on stage and just, it couldn't have been less glitzy.
Yeah,
he's just doing his thing, and it's incredible.
They were just rolling camera on that stuff.
That's right.
Richard Pryor live from the Sunset Strip. This is a Gary asked this question. Was there a moment of our working together in all the 15, 16 years where you worried about something but you couldn't tell me, or you felt like you couldn't tell me?
There are temporarily those things, I think, a lot. But what I mean is temporarily is like I'll have a note or a thought, and I will go through this thing of like, I don't know if this is the right time to mention that. I'm just going to wait till the right time.
Yeah.
And usually the time will come or it won't, and the note falls away and it's fine. But there is a sense of like, I'm definitely, I don't know, maybe I it's genuine for me, and it's also, I guess, part of my job. I'm protective of your creative process. Like, the last thing I want to do is come in and, screw it up.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of times where, but personally now, there's not times when, like, I've pretty open door with you saying anything that, I think, and vice versa, I hope.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's funny, during Old Man in the Pool, there was like a few times where we have very open lines of communication. Like, I was just like, Seth, I can't hear about this one thing anymore.
That's right. Absolutely.
And because my brain gets clogged.
Totally.
Because I'm memorizing this 80-minute monologue, and I'm making changes and tweaks, and I have to hit this moment. I have to be at this part of the stage for the lighting to hit me a certain way. Yeah. But I'm also thinking about how our best friend from childhood died. And so I'm a servant to many masters.
Absolutely. And I think it's actually important. One of the things I said to you, and I stand by it, is I think healthy pushback is great. I think that the healthy part is important.
Yeah.
I think it can be unhealthy, but I think it's, when you're collaborating with someone, if something's going on that's counterproductive, it's so helpful to go like, just to identify it. That's counterproductive.
Yeah.
And then, okay, great. We'll take a different path here. There's a lot of times where people will sometimes push back unhealthfully, where like the worst case scenario is, somebody who's maybe, mean or
a rageaholic, for example. Yeah. We've worked with, you and I have occasionally interfaced with people who have different temperaments than you and I
this
have.
This conversation is a study in not saying
saying what it is, but it's, but we've definitely had a handful of people over the years who we've crossed paths with where you and I think have a very similar reaction to people who have rage issues and anger issues, and kind of, you and I never shout, for example.
Yeah.
I don't think we make ad hominem attacks on people.
No,
we don't say mean things to people.
No. On the job, for sure.
Yeah. And have you, like, over the years in general, like as an actor, director, how do you react when you interface with someone who has something like
God,
that?
God, it's really hard for me. It's really painful that... the project, I won't go into the details, but the project that we worked on where there was one of the issues was there was a person on the staff who was truly a rageaholic, and there was a lot of rage that went our way. And I was literally sobbing at home on four different occasions at home, uncontrollably. It's just like I'm taking it, and then because I don't know how to deal with it in the moment. Somebody once was asking me like for coaching advice on working with an actor. They were going to be working with an actor, and he had heard that this actor was like really trouble, and so he set up a coaching with me, and I didn't know what the coaching was about. And so I showed up and go, yeah, what did you want to work on? He goes, well, I'm working with so-and-so. I just need any tips for that. And I thought, I told him, I said, first of all, this coaching is over because I need to take that class.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Sign me up.
I wish that there was an expert on managing that. It's so hard. It's so counterproductive, that kind of rage.
I remember when we did the first meeting for Don't Think Twice, I said to the crew, the whole crew, said, everybody, this film has a no assholes policy, you don't be mean to anybody, you don't shout at anybody, and if you do that, you're not going to work on the show in the movie anymore.
Wow!
And because I can't, I'm 44, you're a little older than me, I can't do that anymore. Yeah. Like I've reached a point. I'm just like, I can't.
Yeah, I can't either. It's not. And the good news is that if you kind of keep doing this thing, you're able to kind of find the people that you work really well with, and then keep it going. And then that happens less and less and less.
Can we for the person listening who goes, oh, my job is like that in this way, blah blah blah. Can we teach anything through the podcast that's helpful for dealing with those people?
Dealing with the troubles?
People who are mean.
Gosh.
Mean coworkers.
I'm curious, what would you say?
I think that fundamentally all you can do is be really honest about how what the person's saying is making you feel.
Yeah.
And if it continues, then you maybe have to leave.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I think 100%. It's like a two-step process.
That's what I would do certainly differently now. I would the second I identified it, I'd sit down and I'd say, I get this is going on, and this is not about, to the person I'm talking to, I'm saying, this is not about you being wrong or your opinion being wrong or any of that stuff. It's just a conflicty thing, and it doesn't work. I don't think it works for our process. It doesn't work for my process. So that has to change immediately, or it's just not right.
Yeah.
I think that's really important. It's funny because when I called two friends of mine who are like really high profile directors, and the first, when I was describing what was going on, because I was like, what do we do?
you and I were working with someone who was very angry and
challenging
and mean to us.
And they both said independently, fire him immediately.
Yeah, yeah.
And we were like, what? It's interesting. But I think that you're right. You just sit down and talk honestly.
Working It Out is brought to you in part by Liquid IV. We're thrilled to have them as a sponsor. You don't need to be an athlete to need extra hydration through your day. Sometimes you forget to drink water, so it's perfect for that. It's great for me because I really have to stay hydrated, and it's great for long travel days, which is so much of my touring life. This is a very popular product among the staff of Working It Out. My brother Joe said, it's a great alternative to coffee in the afternoon when I want to pick me up. It's sweet, but it's only got 45 calories. It's a great thing to have in the office. Grab your Liquid IV Hydration Multiplier, sugar-free, in bulk, nationwide at Costco, or you can get 20% off when you go to liquidiv.com and use code WORKING for Working It Out. Working is the word, WORKING at checkout. That's 20% off anything you order when you shop. Better hydration today using promo code WORKING. Working It Out is brought to you in part by Helix Mattresses. Helix is our original sponsor. I want to say they were our first or second sponsor ever in the Working It Out history 3 years ago. It's an awesome company. They make phenomenal mattresses. The new one that I wanted to tell you about is called the Helix Elite. They've harnessed years of extensive mattress expertise to bring their customers an elevated sleep experience. The Elite Collection includes six different mattress models, each tailored for specific sleep positions and firmness preferences. Every Helix Elite mattress comes with a 15-year manufacturer's warranty and the same 100-night trial as the rest of Helix mattresses. Working It Out listeners get 20% off all mattress orders and two free pillows. For our Working It Out listeners, go to helixsleep.com/perbigs, promo code HELIXPARTNER. This is their best offer yet, and it will not last long. With Helix, better sleep starts now. This is a slow round. Nicknames you had growing up that were very good or very bad?
Did not like Seath.
Oh,
which is
oh
what
gosh.
I was Seath. Called mostly.
Seath?
Yeah, I don't know what it is, but back in the day, the name Seth, S-E-T-H, people could not say. I was either Zeth or Seath.
Okay.
Like, they could not say Seth.
Is Seath some kind of word I don't even understand?
No,
like seething
in college,
with anger
it actually
or something?
Turned into, like, it was a nickname that I started to like in college. What happened is I went to UCLA and I was in the Hugh O'Brien Awards, which was this thing where they select, you know, their favorite students maybe, and we do a scene showcase in front of a bunch of celebrities. And different celebrities get up and introduce people, and the person who introduced my scene was Hugh O'Brien. He played Wyatt Earp on television. He was like a, you know, big old TV guy. And the theater there sat about 1400 or something like that. And he got up and he said, "Our next scene features Seath."
This is absurd. This is an absurd story. I don't know how your brain
Amy
gets
Resnick.
There. I don't know how your brain even arrives at that.
It does all the time.
I'm going to move on from this. Can you think of a time that you were so scared you ran away?
Oh, yes. Many, sadly. I remember when you were performing in Atlantic City. I think we were working I think we were working on
Think Over Jokes.
Think Over Jokes. And you were there and you had a
bit. And of
bit
course, because we
there.
Have group mind, I know exactly what you're talking about immediately.
Yeah. You referenced Hillary Clinton as a some yeah. kind of a reference.
Yeah.
And some.
And George Bush, I think.
Yeah. And yeah. some guy from the back in this big room in Atlantic City started screaming, "Die!"
Yep.
And it was weird, and nobody went. And then yeah. and we went there to work on the show, and you abandoned the show immediately. You just started doing other stuff.
I just started doing other material. I just did best of karaoke, Mike Birbiglia.
I was like, and I'm crack just, a please.
Yeah, 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 exactly. I mean, I was just doing like, and yeah, I was doing like, and I'm a bear, etc.
But the thing that I remember is that afterwards, you know. I was just like brought up. I was like, "Oh, it's kind of crazy about the thing." And you were shaken. I remember you said you almost left the stage.
Thought I was going to get shot.
Yeah.
So I, for whatever reason, I'm on stage in Atlantic City when you're talking about, and I hear this guy go, "Die, die, die." And it was in the back of the room, total darkness. And it was so menacing. And apparently someone told me later, he was saying, "We didn't die since 9/11.
Yeah.
He repeated it over.
He was too drunk to get the yeah. other part out.
But I heard that that's the intent of what he was saying. We didn't die since 9/11. But all I hear was die, yeah. die, die. It was his defense of George W. Bush. We yeah, didn't yeah, die yeah. since 9/11.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, we didn't all die. I mean, is that the scenario? It was going to possibly happen. All 300 million people die?
Then you should vote for
it's
him.
The leftovers? It's a lot of the leftovers.
That's a pretty low bar. It could be a good campaign slogan. You're not all dead.
Right, you're like, not okay. all dead. Vote for me. We're not all dead. Yeah, so he said, "Die, die, die." And I literally thought I was going to get shot.
Yeah.
And I stayed on stage because yeah. I was doing my job.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was a time. I was going to run away. I know the answer to this, but
five.
All right, I'll go to the next one. What's the sickest you've ever gotten?
Oh, I'm sure you're thinking of I went on my honeymoon to Africa. And is this what you're thinking of?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was one of those things where, like, I was so, you know, when you go going to Africa, it's a different place. And you go to the, I guess it's the Center of Disease Control, and they tell you all the shots and stuff you
sure.
have to take. And you
malaria
learn,
and all
oh,
those
my God,
things,
you learn
yeah.
about all these things. Yeah. And the big thing felt like, you know, malaria is like the big thing.
Yeah.
And so it was like, don't get malaria. And so I just became obsessed with not getting malaria. I actually went and bought, there's this stuff called 100% DEET, which is the stuff the mosquito repellent is like made out of. But
oh
this was
gosh.
100%. It's like fully toxic.
Right.
And I literally poured it all over my body
oh
in
my
the bathroom
gosh.
Of the airplane so that I would not
oh
be bitten
gosh.
By a mosquito. Long story short, I was not only was I bitten by a mosquito, I must have been bitten getting off the plane. It was like because
you got it immediately.
Well, you get I got it 9 days later and it has like a 10-day gestation period.
Absurd.
I went down hard and it you know, I was taking the preventative, I think they're called prophylactic drugs. It's I think the stuff I was taking was called Larium. It was a pill that you take like, you know, twice a day.
This one, are you in Kenya? I forget what country you're
in. Well, Kenya was where I got bit.
Okay.
But I never noticed a mosquito bite or anything. But I
so it was like 9 days later and you're in another country.
9 days later, I was in Uganda.
Okay.
And I was walking on this hike that was like a 3 mile hike, and I'm a hiker, you know. I was like this. And as I was going, God, it's really hot. And I was like, it's just like, oh, this Africa place is hot.
And then this Africa place is hot. What a great observation.
And
wow, this man is astute.
But the thing that I was noticing about it is like I was at this place called the Bogoti Swamp, and I went there to see chimps. I've been obsessed with chimps ever since I was a little kid. And I was like, oh my God, I want to see a chimp. I want to see a chimp. And it was just so hot. And all of a sudden I heard the guy in front of me goes, chimp scat, you know, and he's pointing and there's fresh chimp scat.
Right.
And I was like,
poop.
I don't give a fuck.
Poop.
I am so hot. I gotta lie down and everything. It turned out I was like having a hugely high fever. And long story short, I ended up like getting taken to a clinic in the middle of Africa, no running water, no electricity, just, you know, nowhere there, and was 4 days in the clinic. And Lee was responsible for like going in town and getting water and everything. And you know, so I was there and then I slowly came back, but I lost... Oh gosh, I lost about like 35 pounds, which I did not have to lose. And it was pretty nasty.
That would be a really bad case scenario for a honeymoon is if your husband dies.
It would be bad.
I mean, that's really like, talk about good news, bad news week, you know? You ever do that as a moth story, which I think you should. You should blow that out for a moth story for sure.
Because
think about, we talked about earlier about like, you know, what makes a good story? What makes an engaging story? I'm immediately hooked in that story.
Yeah.
It has the specificity of the DEET.
Yeah.
It has the specificity of being in the airplane bathroom and putting it on, that you're nervous about getting malaria.
Yeah.
Then it has the plot point of you get malaria. Mm. Then it has the unexpected consequence of you're in a clinic that has essentially no doctors or one doctor.
And
of course, the stakes are the highest.
There's so
many life and death.
The other thing is that the tour that we were on basically left us there to die.
What?
they're like, well, we have to go on with the tour, so good luck. You know, they just took off. And then I think 2 days later, they realized they shouldn't have done that. So they sent this guy back, but they were now like, you know, 2 days away of travel. They sent a guy back to sort of be the representative who sat there. And then...
That's a breathtaking story.
It is amazing. It actually does have an endpoint because what happened was I was there, the peak of our trip was to see the gorillas and be out there in the wild with them and everything. And I couldn't walk. I mean, I couldn't, you know. And so they were at this gorilla place for like 5 days. And in the course of 5 days, I went from I can't walk to being able to go on the trek. And everybody in our group had been having trouble seeing gorillas. They saw them like, you know, either way far away or they're in bushes and they couldn't make them out. And we were up there and the guide just says, I'm so sorry. We're not going to see them because it seems like they've gone towards the border and we weren't allowed to go into Zaire.
Yeah.
And then this tracker just kind of shows up and he says, you know, whisper something to the guy, and the guy just goes, oh, they're here. And we walk through bamboo, like about 6 foot of, they cut through it, and there's nine gorillas hanging out in this pasture. And I mean, the silverback was 6 feet away from me.
No way.
Oh, yeah. It was unbelievable.
6 feet away from me.
6 feet. I measured it. I mean, I was like, that is ridiculous. And it was, I mean,
How come you weren't, were you afraid?
No. It's a habituated troop. In other words, the way they do it is they find a troop and then they have found a troop. And then every day they track from where they saw them the day before. So they go to where they were the day before, and then they, with the tracker, they find out where they went through the course of the day. And so hiking around, you see, oh, this is where they slept and everything, and you find them. I actually asked, I wanted to see an unhabituated troop. I thought, I want to see the real thing. And I asked the guide that, and I said, have you ever seen one? And he goes, once. And I said, what's it like? And he goes, let's just say I'm glad it was not my day to die.
Oh my gosh.
And I was like, oh yeah, okay, I'll pass on that. But yeah, anyway, it was mind blowing. And you know, I was just sobbing with happiness, and it was great.
You and I have this another thing in common, which is we're both obsessed with wildlife. Yeah. And I think that there's a relationship between wildlife and art.
Yeah.
Which is to say that there's behavior and there's instincts from wildlife that we observe that's so unadulterated and so kind of thought through and so unselfconscious that I'm drawn to it. I think you are too. So my daughter and I watched March of the Penguins recently and my takeaway from it was we're all just penguins. And when I get on stage doing the old man in the pool, I'm just a penguin walking out to 1,000 penguins saying, isn't it crazy being a penguin? And the final thing we do is called Working It Out for a Cause. And is there an organization that you like to contribute to and I will contribute to them and link to them in the show notes?
Yeah, sure. I'm always happy to contribute to any food bank, and City Harvest is a great one. You know,
City Harvest is cityharvest.org, 40 years rescuing food for NYC.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, people should be able to eat.
This is going to be the first of many Working Out episodes with Seth Barish, so stay tuned. Seth doesn't do any social media or anything like that, so you the only way you can follow him is really to show up at his place of work and give him a CD, a compact disc
of
your comedy.
And tell him that you were on Letterman.
But you can see our show, The Old Man in the Pool, or any number of Barrow Group productions, which are, truthfully, follow the Barrow Group.
Yeah, barrowgroup.org.
Yeah, just an amazing theater organization in New York City. Great actors, great directors, great productions, and great classes.
Yeah.
Thanks, Seth, for being my friend and collaborator all these years.
Thank you, Mike.
Working it out, because it's not done. We're working it out, because there's no one.
That's going to do it for our episode with Seth Barish. His book is called An Actor's Companion. It's so good. You can see our show, The Old Man and the Pool, at Lincoln Center right now through January 15th. Our producers of Working It Out are myself, along with Joseph Birbiglia and Peter Salamone. Associate producer Mabel Lewis, consulting producer Seth Barish. Wait a minute. He's the guest on this, and he's the consulting producer. That's not fair. That's how you get booked on the show. You work on the show and then you're a guest. Da-da. Assistant producer Gary Simons and Lucy Jones. Sound mix by Shub Saran. Supervising engineer Kate Balinski. Special thanks to Marissa Hurwitz and Josh Upfall. My consigliere is Mike Berkowitz. Special thanks to Jack Antonoff and Bleachers for their music. I'm demanding a Bleachers album before the end of the year. I'm doing it on Twitter. I've been very hostile to my friend Jack on Twitter. I've also been demanding he hashtag calls me back. You can join that hashtag on @Berbigs, hashtag Jack Antonoff calling me back. Special thanks to Jay Hope Stein, my wife, the poet. Her book is called Little Astronaut. A lot of the poems actually were in the new one, but it has a whole bunch of other poems that are fantastic. It's at your local bookstore, perfect for the holidays. Special thanks, as always, to my daughter, Una, who built the original radio fort made of pillows. Thanks most of all to you who are listening. Thanks for all the feedback and the nice comments we get on the podcast. If you're enjoying the show, please go on Apple Podcasts. Give us a star rating. It'll take you 30 seconds. You can say one of your favorite episodes. I always find this with podcasts is you don't know where to begin. Like, we've done 90 episodes. It's like, well, where do you start? For me, I always say, like, well, I would listen to the Hasan Minhaj episode. I would listen to maybe Hannah Gadsby was a fun one. I think the Natasha Lyonne one was really fun. There's a bunch of them, but you could say what your favorite one was. For example, the Seth Barish episode. That would be a perfect place to start. Thank you most of all to you, the listeners, who support our little show here. Tell your friends, tell your enemies. Maybe this winter you see one of your enemies shoveling snow in their driveway, and you could help them shovel, and that might clear the air. But you know it would be more helpful than that. Tell them about this podcast you enjoy where a comedian works out jokes and material and process with other creatives. And then let them get back to their shoveling, because there's work to be done. See you next time, everybody.